We're here for the session, Why Do Anti-Reflux Operations Fail in 2018? I'm Kyle Perry. This is Daniela Molina. We're here to moderate this session with you. And we're going to start off with a talk about patient evaluation and selection of to optimize outcomes of anti-reflux surgery. This is Christy Dunst from Portland, Oregon.
So we're going to keep the questions at the end?
Yeah.
We're going to keep all questions at the end of the talks.
Sorry, we're going to have all the speakers speak, and then at the end, we'll kind of do all the questions at once to the panel. And so I encourage you to sort of stay with us as we get through this. I know it's a difficult topic for all of us who do reflux surgery, and hopefully for the last half hour or so of the session, we can just have an interactive discussion with the panel and the audience. So we look forward to that.
All right, welcome everybody. Thanks for the opportunity to participate in this awesome session. I have no disclosures, but I do have a disclaimer. While we all know that there's multiple options for anti-reflux therapy, we are going to be focusing on the gold standard laparoscopic fund application for this talk. So a couple of my fellows are out there, and you might hear, or they have heard this story over and over again, but when I was a fellow in 2005, I presented some data on post-Nissen gas bloat syndrome, and I interviewed 500 patients from around the country and asked them about their gas bloat symptoms. I said, do you have gas bloat after your Nissen? 100% of them said yes. But they couldn't tell me if it was worse or better, the same, or what was going on with it from compared to before their surgery, but they all said yes. Luckily, though, 94% of them did not care. It was not a big deal. They were happy as clams. However, 6% of them said it was hideous, horrible. We've seen these people, and they hate the surgery. They hate the surgeon. They hate everyone. They're miserable, and they make us forget about the 94%. And our job, the purpose of this talk, is to keep them out of the OR. So there are three keys to keeping them out, all right? Careful patient selection, quality surgery, and managing expectations. But even then, some of them are going to slip through. You can't be too hard on yourself. In 1999, our friend Dr. Campos looked at the factors predicting a successful outcome after laparoscopic Nissen fund application. And to my knowledge, this has never been refuted. The three most important factors are abnormal pH testing, typical symptoms, which are defined as heartburn, regurg, and dysphagia, and a favorable response to PPI. It doesn't have to be complete, but a favorable response. This is really important, so I'm going to let it pause for a second and you commit to memory that these are the most important factors that contribute to a positive, great outcome after anti-reflux surgery. However, those people aren't all that we deal with, are they? We have to deal with these problems. I'm going to focus on, I could have gone a million directions with this talk, but I decided to focus on three categories that we see every day and that can cause a challenge when you're trying to decide if you should operate on somebody. So the first one is PPI refractory symptoms. PPI refractory symptoms, there's three reasons. Number one, the patient has GERD, but their acid suppression is inadequate, either because they're non-compliant, they're not taking their meds, even though they say they are, or they are biologically resistant, which some refute. Or the patient has GERD, but the symptoms persist, despite adequate acid suppression, or the patient doesn't have GERD. Now, the first one is easy to deal with because they came to you, as they all do, with their on-medication pH testing, and lo and behold, they still have elevated acid exposure despite their meds. They get sent to you. It's kind of a slam dunk. You don't have to repeat any testing because they already have abnormal score. But what about the other two? And so the question really is a normal pH testing on medication, do they even have GERD? What do you do with these patients? And so we decided to ask ourselves this question in our research facility. Is 24-hour impedance testing on medication, on a PPI, good enough, or is it ever good enough, to proceed with anti-reflux surgery? Now, we as surgeons have no problem with the concept of understanding that gastroesophageal reflux disease is a mechanical problem as much or more than a chemical problem. And the definition is that it's the escape of gastric juice into the esophagus. It is gastroesophageal acid. It is not gastroesophageal acid reflux disease. And again, we as surgeons understand this. So it seems in the light, in the day of PPI, that a test to measure the volume refluxate would be super helpful, right? And that is what multi-channel intraluminal impedance testing does. It measures the reflux of a bolus of liquid, regardless of its composition as well as gas. So the question is it as awesome as we want it to be? It seems like it would make sense. Now, in 2009, Dr. Castell looked at this, and he confirmed what we were thinking, in that PPI therapy does not change the number of reflux episodes. It only changes their composition, confirming what makes sense, right? So based on that, the world decided that it should be the normal value for abnormal impedance events should be 47, just like it is for the gold standard pH test. And later that year, other investigators looked at what happens when you're on medication versus when you're off medication. So they took their 39 patients with persistent symptoms on meds, they tested them, and then they took them off and tested them again. And they found that, lo and behold, just like we thought, an abnormal impedance on medication correlated with an abnormal acid exposure 93% of the time. But importantly, the normal test did nothing to help you decide whether or not a patient had GERD or that did not have GERD. So who knows if they even had it in the first place. So last year, we decided to look at our own patients and see what's happening nearly a decade later. We also found that a normal impedance on meds doesn't do anything to help you with the diagnosis. Now, granted, the pH test is valuable, but the impedance part is not valuable. And if it was abnormal, if the impedance testing on meds was abnormal, a third of those patients ended up having a normal pH test. Now remember, this is our predictor of a good response, is the abnormal pH test. So keep this in mind. The key point is that normal pH impedance testing on meds does not rule out GERD. One in every three patients diagnosed with abnormal impedance on meds do not have abnormal acid exposure. And it's your best bet to repeat that testing off meds, even though we don't like it. Take them off their meds, make them have another tube in their nose, but it is your best bet as the surgeon. So then we thought, well, there has to be patients that you don't have to repeat. You know, what about the patients that have typical symptoms, they have a hernia, you swear that they have GERD? Can we get away with those guys not taking them off their meds? And the long and the short of the answer is no. Even if they have all three of those things, it was not correlative. So then we asked, well, okay, what if it's really bad, hideous, horrible impedance, and they have bad symptoms? Do you have to take them off? Well, in 2013, the French researchers looked at the normal value, and they basically found that 47 might be a little bit too low, and they found the 95th percentile on PPI to be 58. So maybe if we bumped up the value to 58, it would be better. So we looked at our patient population again, and 58 didn't do it for us, but 73 did. 73 impedance events on meds had a 100% correlation with an abnormal acid exposure. So the answer to the question is 24-hour impedance testing on PPI good enough to proceed with anti-reflux surgery? The answer is no, unless it's over 72. Now that's a small number of data, but that is where we're moving currently. Sorry to say, you still need to take them off. So then we asked ourselves, is an abnormal 24-hour impedance test off PPI even? Off PPI, is the impedance worth anything? In other words, is impedance testing ever worthwhile? Is this technology doing anything? So we looked at our patients that had anti-reflux surgery for and with an abnormal impedance off meds. By definition, They had more than 47 impedance events off meds. They were straightforward fundos, no funny business going on, just straightforward cases. We called them 3 years later and asked them to tell us about their symptom resolution. Zero, meaning it did nothing, they're the 6%, or five, they have zero symptoms and they're happy as clams. The overall symptom score for the whole group was 4.19, which is pretty good. So if you look at the two groups separately, on the left is the patients who had an abnormal pH also. So they had an abnormal impedance and an abnormal pH. Those patients, the score was 4.4, compared to the 3.95 of the patients that, yes, we operated on without an abnormal pH. And that was significantly different. But they are still doing well. It's just less well. So you need to be able to know this and if you're going in to make that decision. And that work is still in progress, so more later. So the answer is impedance testing ever worthwhile is probably in carefully selected patients. But watch this space. So now a few words about extraesophageal symptoms. Okay, we know these people, right? These are the people that come to you, their dentist or their ENT tells them, you have abnormal reflux, you need to get this taken care of, without any other testing but their oropharyngeal examinations. And I will just not even go into the data other than saying no. The data is at best 50-50. So if you're gonna operate on just these symptoms, you are taking a big risk. And I'm not saying you won't ever take that risk, but it is a big risk. And it is much better if they have some typical symptoms and confirmatory testing and whatnot that will make them happy. And then if they get this stuff fixed, then it's bonus. But the answer again is just say no. Oop. Something weird happened. There we go. Okay, but cough seems to be a slightly different story. Cough, there's two proposed pathophysiology mechanisms for a cough. One is reflux-induced cough reflex, meaning if you instill acid into the esophagus, you can make people cough if they're susceptible. Or there's the one that most people know about more readily is direct aspiration or microaspiration. It's interesting to know, because all the patients come in on PPIs, right, regardless of symptoms, and the literature does not support this. The literature says that there's insufficient evidence to conclude that a PPI is beneficial in the treatment of cough. Now, if they have GI symptoms and you're treating their reflux for that, fine. But PPI for cough is not supported by the literature. Furthermore, there is increasing amount of literature to demonstrate that when we are pouring PPIs into people's stomachs, we're actually just colonizing their stomachs with bacteria, increasing the endotoxin, which then, if it is aspirated, increases the inflammatory response. This is measured in this study ex vivo, but it is a mess. So the answer is not to give PPIs for cough as the only indication. But what about surgery for cough? This is the most recent CHEST guidelines in cough related to reflux. And buried in it is the answer, and I mean buried. Any excuse they could say but or not, they would. But in it, there's a few things that we should know as surgeons. Number one is that neither concurrent typical symptoms nor abnormal testing has a good positive predictive value. So it's still a guess, even if you've confirmed that. But importantly, a negative pH test has 100% negative predictive value. That's important information. Now, in this paper, or in the 2006 guidelines, they proposed this clinical profile of patients that might respond to anti-reflux surgery. And then, in the interim between then and now, they prospectively followed the patients that they treated this way. In summary, so you can't read all of that, is that you have pulmonary, rule out everything else, and you maximize their asthma treatment, and then abnormal, and they have an abnormal pH, then they'll probably do well. According to the two studies done by these guys, 91% predicted cough responded well. So even the naysayers had to begrudgingly say there's a role for surgery in cough in carefully selected patients, and we know who those naysayers are. Anyway, enough about that. Be careful with cough, but it can be helpful for sure. A few slides about concurrent gastroparesis. In 2011, we got the LOTUS trial. The LOTUS trial is the randomized clinical trial comparing PPIs to controlled laparoscopic anti-reflux surgery. And among all the findings that we're interested in reflux and whatnot, one of the interesting things I found was that there is a lot of gas bloat in these patients with whatever treatment. It's before surgery, after surgery, with PPIs. It's all over the place. But when is it more than GERD-related gas bloat? And when is early satiety more than just feeling bad after because you have reflux? When is vomiting actually regurgitation, and when is regurgitation actually vomiting? What are your patients telling you? What are they even talking about? So when do they actually have delayed gastric emptying is the question. And some of you don't care because we know that the Nissen improves gastric emptying regardless of the underlying delayed gastric emptying. So some of you may not care, which is what we thought as well when we reviewed our own experience looking at patients with delayed gastric emptying. We took nearly 600 patients that came in with referred for GERD. And we found that 25% of our patients had significant enough symptoms that warranted us to check a gastric emptying study. And of those, half of them had delayed gastric emptying. So we took these patients, we did a Nissen on all of them, and the ones that were really bad, their gastric emptying study scared us, we did a pyloroplasty on them as well. And when you look at the two-year outcomes, we can clearly see that the patients with delayed gastric emptying, which are the yellow and the orange, had worse outcomes in terms of gas bloat and abdominal pain than the people who did not have delayed gastric emptying. There is a side effect. There's a higher rate of diarrhea if you add a pyloroplasty to a fundo. But we also saw that not only did they have more gas bloat and abdominal pain, but they also had a higher GERD failure rate in the patients who had a Nissen alone compared to the patients who had a Nissen pyloroplasty. This was not significant. But it was significant in other publications. Here, this shows that at 5 years, the patients treated with a fundoplication who had delayed gastric emptying had increased recurrent reflux. So I think it's important, again, not that you have to do a pyloroplasty or that you can't operate on these people, but you need to know what the outcomes are to direct patient expectations. So yes, we all love these guys. We all love them, right? But we have to deal with these guys as well. And you're going to operate on them. But you're going to have very careful patient selection. You're going to have to do good surgery and manage their expectations so that they know what they're in for. Remember, we are looking for this, not this. Thank you very much.